The title of the lecture is Women and Sometimes Men, and the reason that it has that title is because the book I think that has meant the most to me in terms of understanding the problem, psychologically speaking, of women and men. Let me see the priority I give women and men in today's world, is a book by Florida Scott Maxwell with that title, Women and Sometimes Men. And I wouldn't take a whole session on this if this book were available to you, but because of the fact that it's gone in and out of print, like so many very good things, I thought perhaps it would be a good idea this year if I took a little time to just go over some of the things that are in this particular book. Florida Scott Maxwell is a woman of very clear perceptions and a rather muddy style as far as writing. She is not like Dorothy Sayers, who has clear perceptions and a clear style, but whose personal life was not quite so involved in the kinds of ordinary struggles that women usually have to put up with. So Dorothy Sayers really lived in, quote, a man's world and fought her way through there and made it very clear that it was not man's in the term of being a particular sex, but that it's man's world in terms of its being belonging to every human being. And what Dorothy Sayers affirmed very strongly, as we've seen in the discussions during the week, has been that a human being is a human being is a human being. It has nothing to do with the sexual gadgets he or she may have. And Florida Scott Maxwell, on the other hand, was a woman who was married and had children. She was a grandmother, and those of you who are in the lifestyle program, and some of you who have investigated the books in the bookstore, know that there is a book down there called The Measure of My Days, which is a book written by this woman when she was 80. And it's one of the most remarkable little testaments of the maturity of age and what it means to grow old in with passion of anything that I've ever written. I mean, that I've ever read and that has been written. And the idea that somehow that old age is kind of a wonderful, quieting, mellowing period in which there are no more struggles is completely belied in Florida Scott Maxwell's book, The Measure of My Days. Because, as she says very clearly in that little notebook, in my 70s, I thought perhaps, I had come to some agreement with life, but now I find I'm more passionately involved than I ever was. Now, to me, that is a great statement to be made. I do not like to be enclosed in a coffin before, I've been forced there. And somehow, that is the attitude that many people have, not toward just old ladies, but toward old men as well. And so although Florida Scott Maxwell is a champion of the needs of women in a specific way, in a way that Dorothy Sayers is not, she is, in a real sense, a champion of human beings and of their lives, and of the quality and vitality of life itself. And when she discusses in this book the masculine and feminine problem in every individual, she is probing something that Dorothy Sayers was not involved in. Dorothy Sayers did not enter into that whole realm. I think she rather, I don't say she looked down her nose at the psychologist, but she wasn't paying too much attention to Jung, whereas Florida Scott Maxwell was a Jungian. And she found one of the great awakenings of her life came when she studied the psychology of Jung at the Jung Institute in Switzerland, and became, this was after the children were grown, and she became a psychological counselor. The interesting thing, for those of you who have read The Measure of My Days, you know that also in that book comes the opening up of her life to who God is in Jesus Christ. And it's really quite an explosive kind of thing that happens to her when she realizes that he is really the one that she's been seeking, and she never would have sought him if he hadn't already found her. And yet it doesn't come off in any kind of a Sunday school, you know, kind of thing. It's a very honest assessment of her own experience of life as she moves along day by day. The reason I took the time to talk about her in her old age is because it's quite a thing to be able to see a person writing and feel the vibrancy and the vitality of that person at the time in the 50s and 60s, that is, of the years. This was copyrighted in 57, and the book that is on the lifestyle list was written in I think 70 or 72 printed. And it's a good thing to be able to realize these are the two books that we have of hers, at least in the American printing. She wrote some plays and a few articles, but these are the only things she's written. And I think I would be very proud if I had been able to produce two books such as this, with such a procession as there is in the two books from one point to another. The problem that she addresses is one that I think is very clearly stated when you listen to this part from the introduction to the reprint of her first book. If men are discovering that they need the very depths of the feminine within their own natures, it can arise blindly and in an inferior form. Permissiveness can belittle life until it seems unworthy of effort. Surely the truth is that life demands greatness of us, responsibility, stamina, vision, forgiveness, and unlimited courage. Is the truth also that we recoil from such a demand and choose the shallow and meaningless? No wonder if the young protest. In their confusion and anger, there is also compassion, idealism, and justified disillusionment. Are we in a spiritual revolution demanding reality, the truth about society and ourselves, or are we seeking the relief of our own downfall? To me, reality is difference, tension and balance, effort, the grace of humility, and the pain of growth. Now those last little few words, I think, are quite typical of the way in which she sees her whole life, and which you sense as you read The Measure of My Days, that she has not given up anywhere, at any point in her life, the fact that there is pain of growth, and that reality is difference, tension and balance, effort, the grace of humility, and the pain of growth. Now, she takes two quotes as the sort of the spin-offs for this book. One of them is from Jung, written in 1927, Women in Europe. The modern woman stands before a great cultural task which means perhaps the beginning of a new era. It's in the 20s. And then Lyle Trilling, who is a great literary critic, in his introduction to The Bostonians, which is a book by Henry James, a brother of the William James that we have in such quantity down in the bookstore, and Meredith and I have been trying to send some of them back because we did get more than we planned. So if anybody wants to read some very good psychology, I will say that William James is a good writer. But his brother, Henry, is a famous American novelist. And he wrote this on the death of his mother. Now, I want you to listen to this because this is what has been the problem for men and women in terms of their understanding of women's position, and also the glory, you might say. He writes of his mother, "She was our life, she was the house, she was the keystone of the arch. She was patience, she was wisdom. She was exquisite maternity." That's Henry James. Then Trilling adds, and this is his comment, the critic's comment, "His mother was the strength that is not power, as the world knows power, the strength of conservation, the unseen, unregarded, seemingly unexerted force that holds things to their center. She had lived the ancient elemental course of life, which is without theory or formulation, too certain of itself, and too much at one with itself, even to aspire." Now, I give this to you advisedly because one of the reasons that women, as historically speaking, have not made great explosive developments in all sorts of fields, whether they're in science or literature or explorations, whatever, it isn't always because they haven't had the education. They haven't certainly had the opportunities that men have had, but they haven't had the dissatisfaction. You see, they haven't had the feeling of frustration that there's a frontier for them, that they still have to get beyond that, because of the fact that by their whole makeup and the way in which a woman generally related to the huge production of family life from early days and on, she had lived the ancient elemental course of life, which is without theory or formulation, too certain of itself, and too much at one with itself, even to aspire. Because if you're going to work toward something, or you aspire toward something else, there's got to be a split someplace in your person. You've got to have a disgruntlement with the way things are. You can't be so completely taken up in what you're doing that nothing comes into your horizon and says, you know, there's a mountain over there to climb. Aren't you going to climb it? You know? Well, for the average woman who really was involved in all the activities of her home, and as Dorothy Sayers, how many of you have read Are Women Human? You know, I would advise the men to read this. I really think it's stupid that that men never read anything women have written about women, as I said before, almost as if they knew it all in the first place, or they don't like what they're going to hear, so why spend the time on it? But what Dorothy Sayers does is affirm the peculiar quality of being a human being in this. And what she does develop in one place that fits very well with what Trilling talks about when he describes what what a woman has been all the time, she brings up the fact that men always say, well, Women, where should they be? Well, they should be in the home, of course. That's where they belong. Well, you know, they really do belong there. Well, at this point, somebody is likely to say, yes, that is all very well. It is the woman who is always trying to ape the man. She is the inferior being. You don't, as a rule, find the men trying to take the women's jobs away. Not from them, anyway. They don't force their way into the household and turn women out of their rightful occupations. Of course they do not. They have done it already. Let us accept the idea that women should stick to their own jobs, the jobs they did so well in the good old days before they started talking about votes and women's rights. Let us return to the Middle Ages and ask what we should get then in return for certain political and educational advantages and privileges which we should have to abandon. It is a formidable list of jobs. The whole of the spinning industry, the whole of the dyeing industry, the whole of the weaving industry, the whole catering industry, and, which would not please Lady Astor, who apparently was a strong temperance woman in England at the time that Dorothy Sayers was writing this, perhaps, the whole of the nation's brewing and distilling industries. Mm-hmm. All the preserving, pickling, and bottling industry, all the bacon cure. Minus would make a good poem, you know, for a lot of modern poets. All you have to do is list a whole lot of, you know, real mouth-watering terms, and you've got a poem. Is that right, John? And since in those days a man was often absent from home for months together on war or business, a very large share in the management of landed estates. Here are the women's jobs, and what has become of them? They are all being handled by men. It is all very well to say that woman's place is the home, but modern civilization has taken all these pleasant and profitable activities out of the home. They should come to Holden Village and find out what happens here. I mean, the men are learning to knit, and the women are learning to dye again, and, I mean, dye. Where the women looked after them and handed them over to big industry to be directed and organized by men at the head of large factories. Even the dairy maid in her simple bonnet has gone to be replaced by a male mechanic in charge of a mechanical milking plant. Well, they haven't been able to replace the cow. Now, it is very likely that men in big industries do these jobs better than the women did them at home. The fact remains that the home contains much less of interesting activity than it used to contain. Now, the reason I'm reading these two in conjunction with each other is, you see, the woman that Henry James, that Trilling is talking about, that was Henry James's mother, was part of that long history of women who were really involved in very meaningful and creative jobs, exhausting, of course. But the fact that they did require mental and real intellectual grasp of things that we sometimes think, you know, that wasn't necessary, they just learned to do it. Well, learning to do something requires a good deal of mental ability. And although I think the only thing that most people did not allow for was the actual education of women in intellectual abstractions and dealing with philosophy and that kind of thing in those early days. But otherwise, a lot of the men weren't involved in that either. Particularly the men that were married, it was the most of the real learning was not in that field, especially in the Middle Ages. The monks and the people who lived in the learning communities were the ones who knew things and who studied things. The average man didn't know all that much more probably than his wife did. And she had to know a great deal in, as Dorothy Sayers says here, in terms of management. So you see the unity with which a woman was living over all these years was one of a real delight in her work and in her meaningful occupation. Now, Dorothy Sayers, those of you who have read anything to any great extent by her, realize that her concern has always been that a meaningful job, meaningful work, is essential to the life of any human being. If a person is going to live fully, you have to have a meaningful kind of job, something that really has validity as far as you're concerned, not just a cheap plastic kind of a make time kind of a thing, but a real job that you feel is essential to do well. And this comes right straight across the board in terms of understanding the position of women. I think this is something that Florida Scott Maxwell does not develop quite enough, but she is coming at it from a little different angle, and therefore doesn't bring it up perhaps in quite such an obvious way. But I think it's important to remember that the reason for a lot of non-interest as far as our grandmothers and great-grandmothers and so on in terms of development and education and so on was because they were really involved in a wholesale factory operation running the business and everything else in their own home, whether it was a farm or a city or wherever. And you see this also happening now. We noticed it particularly in the Philippines, that there were many, many women who were really they had the purse, they had the know-how. The men were wandering, a lot of them. And the women were the ones that really had it put together. So I think you don't have to feel that it's because we just suddenly become independent. I think it's a whole part of our cultural revolution and the industrial revolution. The whole thing has worked together so that now there isn't that kind of meaningful work for women, and all of a sudden she explodes into the fact that she's got to have a position in life that has a validity too, and that she doesn't have to be structured by the fact that she happens to be, quote, female.
Mary Kent? Mm-hmm. Just on her autobiography, and many times when you listen to people talking about this, you know, this subject, you wonder what their experience has been, and so much is being written today from people who've essentially gone to college and then gotten into publishing and then written a book on, you know, this subject. Her past was really intrigued me. She was a Broadway actress, and first quit that and married and raised a family. And then she was, how old, Mary? Was she 55?
No, I said she was after she was 40. She when her children were grown up enough, then that's when she took her Jungian training.
She studied and got her doctorate in psychology, had that going until she was, what, 75?
Until she retired.
Mm-hmm. I think it was even late, you know, later. So here's a person who had, you know, multiple kinds of experience. And really broad. You know, she could bring a lot more to the subject than most of them.
I'm going to read a part of the beginning part of this lecture just because I want to be sure that I get it covered before, just to be 12 o'clock, I'm always going off on tangents. So I thought I wanted to just read a little bit here, and then I'm going to read some things from the book itself, because as I say, I think we have a copy in the library still, but I had six copies, and they all walked off with, I don't know whether they were with pants on, trousers, Dorothy Sayers has a very funny little thing on the complaint of the people at the time that she was writing, that the bishops were really disturbed by the bad habit that had suddenly become part of the British females, and that was that they were wearing trousers. And I thought, well, you know, I know in Norway when we were there in the 30s, they felt, you know, I had a very devout Christian cousin who would not wear pants to go skiing, and she wore a big skirt and then sort of woolen bloomers underneath it that matched the top, you know, but she had a skirt on the top. I couldn't believe it, but that's right.
I've seen you wear an outfit like that. Can you get on a boat?
Not a bad outfit. I know, quite smart. I can see Vogue coming out with something like that, you know, looking very appealing, but I can't say Otelia looked so appealing. Can we define woman without immediately bracketing the definition with the role traditional or untraditional? She is so often a human being, a person, away from men, that she may develop herself as an actress on man's approach. Did you think that's true? Don't you think a lot of women really are not themselves when they get with a... Well, I don't think it's so true now, but this was true. Women really... Oh, I used to get just... the curl, my blood, I'd get so mad. And then I'd find the same thing happening to me, and that made me even worse. But it's true that there was, for a long time, and I don't know if it's so true now, as I say, but it was certainly true, that women always played a double role. Because when they were around men, well, you know, if you talked about anything very weighty around most boys your age, you didn't plan to go out with them, because they weren't interested in, you know, in spending money on you if they thought you were smarter than they were, or that you wanted to discuss anything. After all, you don't take girls out to discuss things. That's what I was informed when I was in college. I was going with three boys and three guys, and they were, and one of them had quite an argument with me about why I didn't care to what we call neck in those days. I don't know what you call it now, but I said, no, I don't want to. I'm not interested in that, Whitey. And he said, look, Mary, he said, look, if I want to talk philosophy, he said, I go out with Butch. That was true. If I want to go hiking, if I want to go skiing, he said, I go out with Paul Boo. He said, what do you think I go out with you for? And I thought, well, this is the last time you're going to go out. that is true, though. I mean, I think that's typical. You know, it's not just... That didn't just happen to me, as you, most of you girls can vouch for, it's not. But the good thing about it now is that I think in our present day, women have been accepted sort of over the board as possible communicators in an intelligent way, and it's certainly every bit as intelligent as the men are. Depends on, you know, I mean, I think people can accept people as human beings much more than they did. But it was true that for a long time there was this kind of acting sort of thing that women got into, and that was a problem. But you can see that why women's lib finally just came to the fore, because when there was this lack of fulfillment in a woman's life, as she looked toward if she was going to be married and have children, there wasn't, I mean, so much of what would ordinarily fill her life was being taken care of by the industries, and so there wasn't the kind of thing that would really fill an intelligent, energetic human being with a sense of validity as far as work. And therefore, there would naturally arise a feeling of wanting to know, isn't there something more to being a human being than the kind of bracket that I have been placed in. the only problem with this is that although we are, as women, are have been in this bracket, and we do have, as men do, a combination of the masculine and feminine in our psyches. That is, we all have, I mean, every woman in this room and every man in this room has both and. You don't have just one side of you. You're not just a man or just a woman. You are a mixture. When we were created as them, you know. We weren't created as two separates, you know, with entirely different kinds of beings. The breath that came into us was from God, and it came into us as the Adam. That's the way the original word puts it, the way it's described. And therefore, all of us have this conflict of a masculine and feminine tendency that comes up in different ways in the way in which our personalities develop. Now, you know this from psychology if you've studied it, but a lot of you, as I myself am very often, you know, sort of shove this aside because I think, well, it's just a term, you know, I don't have to really deal with it. Well, Florida Scott Maxwell is quite concerned that we not, you know, throw this off into some kind of a textbook approach, but that we actually see that this is something you have to deal with all your life. There's always going to be a masculine and a feminine side coming up and down inside of you, and I don't care whether you're a man or a woman, that's going to be true. And there's nothing, you know, you don't have to, you know, say, oh, I'm ashamed of having any feminine side to me, or if you're a woman, I'm ashamed to have any masculine side. What is really bad is if you are ashamed of it, because then you don't deal with it, and it doesn't become something that you actually can use and be in control of, and it can be used to the good. What has happened to most women who've had this masculine side down inside and pushed it down because they think they should let it out, you know, they've become absolute tigers in their homes and really run their husbands almost to ground, always by indirection, never coming out in front, but freely just almost murdering the man that they lived with, and very often simply engulfing their children. She has a very good little description of what happens to women when they let their masculinity just come out in a feminine style so totally that it's going to fool everybody. We see women who are very fluid, very feminine, like the total woman maybe, and who pour out their feelings like an engulfing cataract. They ensnare in the excess of their emotion. They are immune to reason, hurt by demarcation, and they ward off hardness and clarity as though these were the evil that their love must deny. But behind the torrent of their softness is an implacable will to power. And what affects those about them is not their softness, but their tyranny. No one can escape some encounters with these many extremes of behavior, each displaying clearly its own striking contradiction. Nor can we be blind to the revolt among families and friends. We all begin to understand each other so well that we feel a mounting need of understanding ourselves. Why do we behave as we do? And why will others not see themselves as we so cleverly see them? It is an old predicament, but now our eyes are being helped to open. And she,
what page is that?
That's page 19. And she talks about the problem of women in this respect, that this is the way it comes out. And that's why I say it's important that you recognize your femininity if you're a man, your masculinity if you're a woman, that these are good parts of you so that you become an interesting person. You're not just a You know, everybody can predict what you're going to do. Well, of course, he's a male chauvinist. She's a woman's lib. I mean, don't put people in those little categories. Allow them to be, you know, to have a chance to be what they are, and you'll find that they can be total human beings too, just as you are. You know, I think whenever we put people in categories, you know, we're putting ourselves up here. As I remember Will Mochen said, you know, the trouble with telling people something, you know, giving them good advice, is that you right away feel like, you know, well, I really know better than you do, of course, so I'm being, you know, I'm helping you out. And that's the only problem. When you put people in categories, this is the way it very often turns out to be, that you are putting yourself above them. Explanatory terms are difficult to find, and there may well be objections felt at calling, for instance, feeling feminine and thought masculine, since it is obvious that men feel as well as think, and that women think, though infrequently, as well as feel. The terms are teasing, but attitudes and attributes have been roughly grouped in this manner for a long time. A man in a fussy, indeterminate mood is called womanish, while a woman's vigor and dominance calls out such saying as, the gray mare is the better horse, or it's clear who wears the trousers in that family. Well, that was way back when nobody wore trousers except the male of the species. But, you know, you understand the point. But there's a further symptom of our time that is relevant to our subject, and that is the constant talk of relationship. In politics, in psychology, in industry, relationship is spoken of as a thing in itself, an essential thing which, if ignored, disturbs organization and easily ends negotiations. The bond between people has come to be regarded as the precious bridge across which reason and trust can pass. It is as though we've become so conscious of the division between individuals, of their lonely uniqueness and their baffling difference, that all hope of communication and security now rests on our ability to relate consciously to one another. Have you ever thought of that? That relationship was never talked about very much until within the last, last part of the century. We didn't make a big thing of relationships. That's the big word, you know. How do you relate? How does he relate to the group? Does the group relate back to him? You know, so and so. We see that thought implies defined difference and so brings cause for conflict, unless feeling creates a bond wherein some sameness may be discovered. And she suggests that one of the reasons we are so involved in trying to find relationships is that women, by their very nature of the jobs they had, the way they lived, and they're leading with feeling, we're very often working on relationships. I mean, unconsciously, that's what they were doing. And when women got out of that kind of emphasis, you know, okay, then we had to start putting psychological jobs to work and start developing relationships, because men weren't going to do it, women weren't going to do it, so we're going to have to work on relationships, because they weren't being sort of taken care of in a natural way by what we understand as a rather feminine principle, because of the fact that it's a kind of a feeling thing that you think about when you think about relationships. Well, it isn't really, because you see, it does involve a lot of intellectual astuteness to be able to relate to somebody, but you can't be all that self-conscious about it, or people know it, and they know you're being very aware of, I'm relating to you. You know, and you can't be that way. So there's a lot involved in this particular kind of job that was really taken care of, she thinks, by the way in which women lived in the days before they came out of their homes and now became developed more of their masculine side than just their feminine. How convenient it would be, how restful and satisfactory if all women possessed this feminine quality of feeling. But sadly enough, it is not so, for countless women lack it, and many men possess it to perfection. Now, is that to be, are you supposed to be dismayed at that, if a man possesses feeling and a woman doesn't? Well, you see, because we've got this fixed image in our mind that a woman is a feeling person and a man is a thought person, you right away think, well, he's kind of womanish, and the woman is a tyrant or aggressive if he moves in the thought world. You see, that's not fair, because we're all human beings with a mixture, and we should be allowed to be somewhat what we are and not have to be ashamed of it. One is not born a feeling type because one is born a woman, and one is not born a thinking type because one is born a man. Feeling in men is often fresh and life-giving. Men's feeling is seldom overused, while women know that feeling is expected of them, and so they ape feeling they do not possess. And that very often happens to us. You know, we lots of times, you know, feel like we're expected to have a feeling about something, and even if we don't feel it, as women, we sort of feel like we ought to, because otherwise people are going to think, you know, you're not, don't you have any feelings at all? And yet a man isn't expected to show up that kind of thing. Yes, men ape the thoughts, that's true. They turn out false feeling automatically as the trade jargon of their sex. Many women are born with inferior feeling that is blunt and insensitive. And how much help have any of us had in the training of feeling? And this is something that we talked about yesterday when I talked about Lewis and the use of literature, and that when you get involved, as Lewis talks about, in reading and in reading novels where something happens to you, you get what the Greeks called the pathos, not pathos and, you know, that kind of thing, but in terms of feeling, you get a training in feeling if you read with the kind of attention that Lewis was talking about. And that's really an important thing. I don't know, I think that we don't want to think of literature, as I said, as an escape, but certainly it can be a training in feeling, and that's what she's talking about. It has long been the denied value, though now it meets with honor. She's really quite funny when she says, for example, she talks about the problem women have if they get married. And they have had they've had a job, they've had a career. And she says, well, you know, it's true that women are varied, though perhaps not so varied and not so defined as men, but one woman does differ from another, so that any generalization that is made will be untrue of most, but true of a few. Perhaps their chief problem is that though they differ as individuals, they are all expected to play the same role. Have you men ever thought that every woman who gets married is expected to make a home? You men are not, if you get married, are not expected to, quote, make a home. You go out and make the money for the home, but you do have a job that is not the only thing then that you do is relate to your family. You also are relating to the world outside. You're doing a job that you were trained for. The job that your wife was trained for, she no longer is doing. Supposing she's a chemist. Maybe she's a marine biologist like Meredith. What are you going to do, you know? Well, you can have little fish at home. You can have aquariums. I don't mean you're going to breed them, but on the other hand, how do you make that jump? How do you make that jump? It's one thing to be a liberal arts major. That's not so difficult, because then maybe you have time to read a book once in a while. But if you're trained in science, that's a lot harder to move into a home and adapt what you've used to somehow into the home life. Well, she says, Of course, many are bad at it and are condemned accordingly. But if every man, because he was a man, had to build his own home and continue to build it day after day, we would surely sometimes hear a cry of, but I'm not a natural builder. You know, I mean, just because he's a man, is he supposed to be able to build a house? Well, now I don't think, ladies, that I am carrying out a brief for the fact that you should therefore, you know, insist that your husband does all the washing and all the whatever. But I think there ought to be an understanding that this is a problem that we do need to face and understand, that it isn't all that easy to make that transition. She has a very good example, I think, of the position of most women in any kind of life, the way it's been up at least until now. It's like I don't know how many of you know anything about Chinese drama, the plays they're so delightful. In the traditional drama, the men played all the parts, and they wore masks and great costumes, and it was a tremendous, usually tremendously exciting action. Right in the midst of the drama, there would be a little the little property manager would come in, and he wore just sort of a peasant's outfit, a little black hat on, and his little queue coming down the back, and he would come in, and he would move the things around as it was right for the play when it was happening. And then periodically he would bring tea to the actors. It had nothing to do with the play. It wasn't written into the play, but they needed tea, just as I needed a drink of water. And if I had a proper property manager, he would run in and give me a cup of tea. And that's what happened. No, I have it. But I'm my own property manager. But you see, this is what Florida Scott Maxwell says. This is what women have been. They've been the property managers in the big play. You know, the drama is going on, and everything is great and wonderful and exciting, and somebody has to run around and take care of the little things, and not important to the play itself as far as, you know, the actual action or the aesthetics or anything, but very important if those actors are still able to speak or move around. They need the refreshment of the tea, and they need to have the property moved, or they need to have a sword brought in, and that's the job of the property manager. And she says this is accepted. She said the Chinese accept the two as being properly together, but in real life it is all different. Women are often thought to show too much, and now we are told that we should notice the drama, whereas we used to be told it was not our business, except of course to keep it going. We are aware that we cause shouts from the audience, which must mean that we do not give satisfaction, and which could mean that we do our work badly. Woman has for long dealt with the untidy side of life, affording in private the relief of being natural. It is usual for her to concern herself with the things that should not be seen and that give away our incorrigible humanity. Yet she is also the showpiece, the orchid in the buttonhole, the final flourish of decoration. She is, on a higher level, the altar of completeness and the symbol of a fullness seldom reached. So she cannot be glanced at without her being instantly seen as the kaleidoscope she is, or more properly, the paradox she is. So no wonder that she's difficult to define, and let it be said at once that it is most uncomfortable to be a paradox, since it requires great perfection of balance to live it well. So now you men remember that. It's not easy for us to be women when we have to be paradoxes and we have to be able to you know, kind of keep things in balance all the time. I think most women realize too that the fact that feeling has been, you know, our natural is more predominant in most of us than abstraction and abstract thought. It is a problem when you suddenly have to let all this become out in the open and you have to find a place for it, and you have to be able to sort of organize it. And you find a real problem, a lot of women do, when because even if this is not a public thing, for instance, many women in their feeling life relate very well to all their family, but they, when their masculine thinking life is allowed to come in. Now remember, when we talk about masculine and feminine, you know, don't feel put down if you're a woman or a man. I mean, these are just categories and just titles or terms, but we're just using it for convenience sake and because it is an acceptable way to talk about them. But when her thought life begins to come to the fore, then when her husband, for instance, doesn't measure up to what she thinks he should be doing, it's very hard for her to hide it and pretend that, well, it's all right if you did that little bit of cheating or did this or that, that in her own thought and her own understanding, which is now also very apparent to her, she realizes is wrong. And yet how does she no longer is in the feeling that everything my master does is right, and I never can say anything wrong or think anything wrong about him. Now, when this happens in a relationship, this is a problem, because men have been used to expecting from their wives the kind of affirmation and agreement and comfort that they need. What if she comes along with a feeling of that you sense that there's a criticism there? What do you do with that? It's a problem. And it's going to be present. I don't care, you know, whether you're married this year or 10 years from now. You're going to have it. And it's not easy. The only difficulty is, and I think women should be aware of this, that that very often women, when they begin to be thoughtful about something, and they begin to lead with that, they become like Florida Scott Maxwell says. She says that the masculine begins to take over, and suddenly you look at a marriage that looked very happy, and suddenly this man is run off with the secretary. And she says, "Real, I think we mentioned it yesterday, I mean, she could have been a real fluffhead. You know, what does he see in her? And she had that beautiful wife, you know, wonderful woman. And why he ran off with her? Oh, no understanding it. Well, you know, that wife may not have been apparent. It may not have been apparent to the public, but she may have been living out her masculinity quite strongly, and become a real sergeant major in the way in which she was, you know, marshaling all her ideas and her thoughts, and." In such a way that, she says here, the, I have to read this to you because it's really quite, really pretty well done, I think. I think we all feel it. We all know it's true. Well, I had the, I had that listed here. I must have the wrong page. But suddenly the husband has discovered that the sergeant major and his wife is coming to bed with him, with her battle ribbons on. And she even has a carryover of her military tones of voice. Well, it's no wonder that the husband decides to go AWL. Because, after all, you know, it's uncomfortable. She's got her uniform on, and all her battle ribbons, and she clinks, and, you know, and she, as Florida's Maxwell says, she carries her military tones into bed with her. And, you know, if that's not what you go to bed for, it's hard on most men. And it's hard on the woman to understand her position, too, because she doesn't know how to deal with this masculinity that becomes practically a military thing. And she's quite concerned that we somehow be able to face this and deal with it so that it does not become a reason for divorce, but that it does become a way in which we can become more total human beings rather than split and just emphasize one side or the other. She talks about in here that I think it's very important, before we go to discuss a little bit more with on some of the things that Dorothy Sayers talks about, is the fact that most people today talk about the fact that we have a very grave need in our home life, that families are in really dire need. And one of the reasons for it, Florida Scott Maxwell feels, is that society really would like to have women stay at home, even if they don't have all these marvelous occupations that they used to have to keep them there. But because somebody needs to be there to make the home a happy place. Well, you know, in a sense, in order to make the home a happy place, she says, you almost have to be willing to be yourself an empty place so that people can dump their sins down there. But she has a whole chapter starting on page 156, chapter 15, called They Dump Their Sins Down. And she says this: a home has always been a refuge, and in this noisy, crowd age, the individual craves a place where the individual values may flower, a place where freedom and quiet may still be found, where the unexpected and the idiosyncratic abound, where the individual is honored, and where all happens because an individual liked or believed or loved. With all our hearts, we want homes like this. We know that no one but a woman can make them, and of course, we beg her to do just this. Though homes are not always so good, almost the same phrases can describe a place without freedom or privacy, a battleground where all behave badly and think that they're right to do so, believing a home to be expressly provided so they may dump their sins down. One has to behave badly somewhere, and where is it safe but at home? Who will stand colds and moods and tempers and every possible reaction to the pressure of the world but a wife and mother? This battering is inherent in life and must be received by someone, and the someone is the woman. It is she who creates a home that will shelter unhappiness and happiness. It is she who works and makes possible the comfort and the quiet and the gaiety that others enjoy. Home is her workshop. Often she is the one person who has no right to be ill in it. And I think most of you who know that your mothers really have not been ill very much. I was very fortunate not to get ill till after my children all grew up. Didn't get asthma until 10 years ago, and I thought how fortunate I was that I didn't have it when my children were small. But on the other hand, I do know women who have been, you know, seriously ill, and it's, you know, the children have really rallied around. It's been a wonderful thing even there. I mean, not it's wonderful to be ill, but you know, you don't have to be healthy to be a mother. In a home where she does all the work, everyone may feel guilty at what they receive and take her temper as moderate price for what is given them. All this being true to some degree, it is most natural that everyone begs women to remain in the home, for there they are needed beyond counting. It must be mentioned that if a woman wants an interest of her own in her home, her family may feel wrong, mock at her interest, and even say it's selfish of her to give it her attention. She may do the things she likes to do rather badly, like the amateur she is, She may very well use her interest as a weapon to hit her family with, but she needs it as our lungs need air, and the delight of creative work to a woman who for years has lived for others is an incomparable experience. And this she's referring to people, you know, women who maybe, you know, decide to make a studio, a painting studio out of their, one of their empty rooms upstairs after the children have all flown, and or she decided to weave, or she wants to write, or pottery, or maybe she decides to have aquariums. Well, I think, you know, we always talk about the arts as if that's the only thing women ever prepare for. And what, you know, why shouldn't a woman have a chance to do something? Maybe she wants to raise a specific kind of plant. You know, maybe she'd like to have a greenhouse. And they say, oh, well, you know, I suppose. As if she had no real right, but you have to excuse her. She's, you know, she's got to have her little fun. As if she is not as much of a human being as anybody else. I think her description of a home here is excellent in terms of what a home is and does. But I also think that we have to realize that in today's world, homes are not just the product of the male of the species. That is, not just the female of the species, the male and the female species together make the home. That is, they weave it together. It's a real tapestry of a home that's not just the private job of the woman.